Hey, everybody. I'm Ken. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Yeah, I want to thank you for inviting me to your group tonight, and thank you, Sam, for extending the invitation. My sobriety date is June 20th, 2006. I'm a member of the Design for Living group in Richmond, and we meet on Monday nights at 8. We have an open speaker meeting. If you're ever in town, drop by. We'd love to have you. So as the gentleman described, my job is to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And the best I can tell, I've been in the grips of this thing called alcoholism. I wasn't a full-blown alcoholic, but I was influenced by alcoholism and being in an alcoholic family. Our literature describes alcoholism as a family illness, and that's what I was in from day one. I had no idea, you know. But I knew I always had that feeling of separateness, of being different, of being not really being able to integrate into life and into relationships and everything the way I wanted to, the way I felt other people were doing without a lot of effort on their part, and the way I desperately wanted to, but kind of had to fought, you know, no matter how much I fought or struggled to fit into the family better, fit into friendships better, fit into whatever. I always just felt like I was still kind of on the outside somehow. And that started from, like I said, from day one. I had an alcoholic mom. Well, I had no idea mom was an alcoholic. I'm a little baby. I don't know what alcoholism is. But the weird thing is my dad and my three older brothers all seemed to understand some code that the family was going to operate by that I had no idea even existed. And so I started learning this weird double life at a very early age, because what would happen is, well, mom never missed a day of work, but she would come home and she'd have her gin sitting on the back of the kitchen sink, and one minute, you know, she'd be skipping around the house and singing, and then as the night wore on, it would just, at some point, it would just blow up, you know, and it would just be total chaos in the house, and that could looked like her chasing kids around and us scrambling under beds and doors slamming, pots and pans slamming. Probably the biggest, most impactful thing on me out of all that was just taking some severe beatings. And that's where I started learning, man, the rules in life and how we present ourselves in life are meaningless. You know, for all of us to dress up and go to, not all of us, dad and the four boys on Sunday dress up and go to church, right? Mom was hanging back at the house. I know today what she was doing. It must have been a tremendous time of relief for her. I know when I was further into my alcoholism, what I wouldn't give for a few hours to be away from my wife and kids and everybody, you know, just be alone and do what I want to do. But I didn't know that was going on at the time. But we're all, you know, we're living through all this turmoil, and then we're going to dress up and put our little suits on and go to church and present as though we're a normal family and everything's hunky-dory and life is good and all this, you know. And I think what I took from that is you can present one thing and you can live something else. And that's how I started to operate at a very early age. I mean, and I just had weird stuff in me, And I don't believe growing up in that family caused my alcoholism. In fact, I'm pretty sure it didn't, because none of my three brothers became alcoholic. But I would do stuff like at a very early age, I would steal fishing lures from the hardware, you know. And it probably doesn't sound like much when you get all this news and social media and all this stuff of what people are doing nowadays. But when you were in some rural community out in it was Lunenburg County, Virginia, where everybody knows everybody. I mean, the nearest houses were a half mile away, and you know, I was on a 65-acre tobacco farm, and you just didn't perform that way. We didn't lie, we didn't cheat, we didn't steal. I mean, had all that weird stuff going on in the house, but apparently nobody was counting that. I think the other stuff I got out of that is probably an inability to trust people the way I should be able to, you know. One minute you're like, oh, we're going to get help with homework, and the next minute you're going to get punched like Muhammad Ali hitting Joe Frazier, you know. Just weird stuff. But all that said, I understand I got this in recovery. I understand my parents loved me and did the best that they could. given everything that we were up against, given that my mom had a genetically based illness called alcoholism. And I don't know if she was ever exposed to a solution to it or not. I think she finally quit drinking. I don't really have a point on an exact age, but well into life, probably close to 70 years old, I think she finally quit drinking. So I wouldn't drink in that an early age. I wouldn't drink in a couple of times in high school. We start getting beer, but mostly I was okay in school. I had a few close friends. I wasn't the most popular guy in there, but I just looked at myself as an athlete, played football, ran track, and those were my guys, and that's who I hung out with. Well, when one or two of them started drinking beer, I was right in there. That peer pressure took about 2 seconds to sway me over in that direction, you know. And so we would start drinking, and I didn't have any real consequences from it, you know. I remember having internal feelings from it and thoughts about it and things that I probably should have paid attention to that I didn't. Like, I remember going out with some guys at halftime of a basketball game and drinking, I guess it was something like Purple Passion, some kind of grape juice mixed with whatever alcohol, and then getting back in the car with Dad and just feeling really guilty because I had to try to cover up that smell and lie about where I'd been and all that stuff. But that said, all that feeling of guilt and whatever, the next time the opportunity came up, I was back on it, you know, and wouldn't get any great excitement from it or anything else. It was just peer pressure. I was kind of like a chameleon. I just wanted to fit in with whoever I was with. I wanted to be liked by whoever I was with. I just wanted to be part of the crowd, I guess. And I remember the first time I got really tore up drunk was at a keg party when I was 16 years old. And had broken up with my first girlfriend, and this party happened to kick off on the same night. And I remember throwing up and having to be driven home, and I cracked a couple of jokes despite barely being able to get my head up and say anything. I made a couple of jokes about smelling like puke on the way home and all this, and everybody was laughing about it. The next day at school, everybody was talking about it that Monday, you know. And I liked it. I liked the notoriety of it. I liked that I was getting this attention. And I think that kind of set my course, you know. I started drinking more and more. But I still didn't get into trouble. It wasn't from lack of trying, you know. I borrowed Mom's car and ran that into somebody one night, but the guy let me go because he was had his own little garage and liked working on cars. And he's like, oh, I just finished all the body work. Now I'm going to do it again. Go on home. Another night, the headlights went out on the car, and I've been driving around with my girlfriend on these abandoned roads, and we were drinking, and I was pretty drunk that night, but I had no light whatsoever. So I pull up to this yard I was going to borrow their phone to call for help, you know, and I'm knocking on the door. And I look over in the driveway, and there's a star on the side of the car. In the driveway, I'm knocking on the sheriff's door, drunk, to get help with getting home. And the guy came out there and said, yeah, I'm Herbert Thompson. Well, I know Herbert. Follow me. And followed him home by his headlights, and that was that. A friend of mine, I was 17. My friend was 16. We were buying beer after football practice at this little country store one day. State trooper walks in there, puts his foot up on the counter right next to us while we're checking out and just watches us, and we go on off. And that was that. All this was happening in the late 70s. If it was happening now, I probably would have been in juvie or, you know. I mean, I drove drunk before all this 30 years of drinking was over with. I drove drunk, it had to be thousands of times. When you're driving drunk nearly every day for year after year, at some points in there, I mean, that's a lot of drunk driving not to get captured. I mean, I blame the police for poor work on that. I was down in the Fan in Richmond one night, and I'd been in this restaurant and had some beer. And when I left, I followed another car. I didn't know them or anything. They went up this street, and I went up the street behind them. And it occurs to me, we're going up a one-way street. Well, as soon as I had that thought, that car turns up the alley. And now I'm about to run head on into a police van. So I did what any drunk would do. I gunned it and well, I got out of sight and then I gunned it. I'm not stupid. So anyway, I go up and I'm taking 90-degree angles away from this police van to try to get away from it. And I'm winding all around downtown Richmond, you know. And finally they got behind me on a long straight stretch. I said, well, I better pull over. I think they're going to get me here. And it was one woman in the van, and she got out, and I mean, I think she was fairly new. I mean, she was just bent out of shape over this thing, and like, why were you running away? Who, me? She said, put me through this field sobriety test and had me standing on one leg and doing a dip at the same time and all this stuff, and she said, I failed. I said, well, I helped my boss move a piano today. This is unfair. And strained my knee at lunchtime moving that piano. She said, well, don't worry about it. I've got the field sobriety test on the way out here. We'll give you a definite answer. So some man shows up in his car and he's got the breathalyzer unit. Well, he hands it to her. She hands it to me. I turned away from her, put my lips on it, took my lips off, blew over top of it, turned around, handed it back to her. They tested it. It came in at 0.0. And the man looked at her like she was crazy. And I got in my car and drove on off. And I kept trying, though. I went down to help my buddy open up his beach house down on the Outer Banks one summer. And I was drinking all day. You can't stay in a deck without drinking. Anybody knows that. And so I started drinking, whatever, 9-10 o'clock as soon as we got down there, drinking. So going home, and he says, you need to go slow along here. Well, he didn't get the words out of his mouth before the blue lights come on towards me. And here again, I'm thinking, well, I've gun it, but there's nowhere to go. I'm on the Outer Banks. You can't. if you do that 90-degree evasion, you're going in the ocean of the sound. I mean, so I said, well, I pull over. I said, this is it, man. There's no way I'm getting out of this one. I was just drunk as a human could be, you know. And I get in this guy's car, and he starts asking me where I'm from and what I do and all this stuff. And I tell him, and yeah, I'm a financial analyst for the tobacco company up in Richmond and blah, blah, blah. And went on, and finally he just shakes his head and he taps the driver's license on the dashboard. He said, take this and get out of here. And I drove on back to Richmond. So I never had those consequences from it. But I don't know. I was getting pretty tore up inside. In the 11th grade, a tractor tire blew up in my face, and so I was in the hospital up in Baltimore all summer, and they never could fix the thing, really. So they grafted some skin over one of my eyes and sent me on back to school right when the school was starting. Well, the kids were very understanding about this. They nicknamed me Cyclops. And that feeling of differentness and all that stuff was just amped up, you know. And now I've got not only the feeling of differentness, but I've got a good dose of depression to go along with it. And so from there, my grades started going down. I can't play sports one year. Just getting a spiral downward, you know. And this is when community colleges were first established in Virginia. Well, you know, it wasn't long after they were established. So all my friends are going off to these big schools, and I'm stuck at home with crazy mom. I'm going to go to the community college. Well, at this point in my drinking, I could still hunker down and do some serious work when I needed to, you know. I'm 18, 17, 18 years old. So I ended up making pretty much straight A's there, and because I didn't have any options. I'm like, I'm not going to stay stuck down here in Lunenburg with this crazy woman. And so anyway, head off to the four-year school, and that's where my drinking just went through the roof. I just drank everything I could. I love beer, you know. I worked construction with Dad all through high school, and Dad wasn't an alcoholic, but he drank socially, I guess you would call it. But we'd usually stop and get a little beer on the way home from work and then throw bottles at the road signs going home, you know. We'd have station wagon with about 8 construction workers in it. We're all throwing bottles and riding around. I guess Dad thought he was doing a service. He was going to teach me how to drink responsibly, you know. And so we had all that going on, but I liked, I just liked all of it. Budweiser, Stroh's, went through a Michelob phase. After I got out of college, I went through all the Canadian beers, Labatt's and German Heineken. Mostly in college, I just drank the cheapest stuff I could find. Kroger had a generic beer called Wiedemann's. It was the only alcoholic beverage I ever met that I couldn't finish. I don't want to misstate this thing. I finished a lot of it, okay? I drank it with flat, and I drank it with cigarette butts in it and every other thing. But sometimes one would just get so stale and nasty, I couldn't drink the thing. But $1.69 a six-pack. But anyway, I just love drinking beer. I like liquor, but I just kind of focused on beer. I drink a lot of Bacardi 151. I drink a lot of Jack Daniels. I drink a lot of Smirnoff vodka. If I had any kind of date or going camping or anything cold, I would get peppermint schnapps or some of these liqueurs and whatnot. And that stuff always made me sick as a dog. I don't know why I got it, but anyway, and I drink it all. And we had a guy in my old home group. He'd say, in my neighborhood where I grew up, you were a chump if you threw up while you were drinking. I'm thinking they would have thought I was the biggest chump that ever hit planet Earth. I threw up every time I drank, and blackout. Well, it wasn't so much blacking out, more just passing out. In fact, when I got to AA, and my first sponsor said, did you ever black out? I said, no, I don't think so. And then as I got a year or two or three in sobriety, I was thinking back, I was like, wow, I remember that night I drove from Blacksburg to Blackstone, which is 3.5 hours, and don't remember a minute of it till I almost hit some soldiers on a bridge over a reservoir down at Fort Pickett. And drove that whole thing in a blackout, you know. And then I could start, as more memory started to come back, I could remember more of those blackouts that I'd been through. So I was drinking it up. Finally, I squeaked through tech with a degree in econ. I don't know why I picked econ. I don't know why I went to tech. I'm an alcoholic. I don't think these things through like other people do. I just come up with some weird thing in my life that looks easier or it looks kind of interesting or exciting or whatever, and bam, I make a decision and I'm in it. And I think the deal on this one was a guy rooming with my brother had decided, I don't know, something happened with my brother's apartment at Tech that looked like it was an easy thing for me to slide into, so that's where I'm going to school. Econ, that was the only class I ever had any interest in, so that's what I'm going to study. It's a decision made. Well, now I get out in econ, I'm like, what do I do with this thing? I said, and here again, I put my keen alcoholic mind on it. I said, I think the economists live in Washington. I should head up there. So I move up to Arlington, and I'm going into Bureau of Labor Statistics and all these places interviewing with my CD average, and they're laughing me out of there. But I hit pretty close to it. I became office manager of a basement waterproofing company. And I'm going to manage their salespeople, and I'm going to do a little bookkeeping for them and whatnot. Well, these salespeople hated me, and I didn't like them much. I couldn't get along with a lot of people. You know, I wanted to. I just never seemed to make it work for somehow. And he said, you're not coordinating the calls right. You're not picking the right people for us to talk to, blah, blah, blah. I couldn't handle these complaints from them. I thought, you know, I'm a perfectionist. Like, what do you mean I'm not doing it right, you know? You don't know all the stuff I'm thinking about when the calls are coming in. You don't understand my thought process. And size, I'm telling you where to go, so get in the car and go, you know. And, so we were struggling along through it until the flood hit. So what happened is it rained or snowed for about 26 days in a row in every basement in Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C., and Southern Maryland was underwater. And now I've gone from taking, you know, half dozen calls a day to the phones ringing like 300 times a day, just nonstop. And here again, the alcoholism hits me pretty hard. One, I'm drunk every night, but I don't think it's a problem at work because I'm not drunk at work. But that illness that centers in my mind, you know, that fear, that unwillingness to take on some tough things and just work through it and learn from it and grow it from it, none of that stuff was in me. And so when these people kept complaining, finally one day during the flood, it occurred to me the fact this wasn't going well was not my fault. It was the little company's fault because they hadn't trained me for this flood. And so at lunchtime, the decision was made. I said, I'm done. I didn't mean I was done that day or going to take an extra 30 minutes for lunch. I meant I'm done. And I got in my truck, and I was blocked in, so I drove across a ditch and down right one, and that was the end of me in Washington. That's the level of consideration I had for people. It's like, well, you didn't train me. You didn't foresee the flood. This is your fault. In fact, I thought they'd wronged me. I'm the one leaving them shorthanded in the middle of a crisis, you know. That's how much consideration I had for people. Anyway, couldn't get into, and my whole time, I thought I had identified my problems in life. I said, one, it's because we live in such a backwoods, remote area, we just don't understand how the rest of the world operates. That's the biggest thing wrong with us. Second thing is we need to get educated. And I sat up here and I goofed around and I got that silly econ degree when I could have done accounting or whatever, you know. So I couldn't get into graduate school because I had poor grades. So Tech had this program. You could come back for 1 year and take however many hours and get, it was like a double major, but it came out as a second degree. So I go back to Tech. I got to have a means of supporting myself. I move in with the head of the statistics department, who was married at the time, and that was weird. I mean, well, I needed a mom. Let's face it, the one I had wasn't working well, so I move in with this woman, and so she's taking care of me, and whatever. Got some pretty good grades, and came out with a finance degree. Here again, I've dodged the accounting degree, the information systems, all that hard stuff. Came out with my finance degree. I got a job auditing chicken companies all over the southeast and southwest of the United States. Most audit companies travel in teams. We were a cheap, small, kind of on the low rung of the ladder auditing company, and we just sent guys out. One guy's going to go see these six companies and collect up all the data and put the reports together and get them done, and my drinking is getting worse and worse. I'd get sent to Alabama for Super Bowl Sunday into a dry county, you know, and I'd go in these stores and just chew these people out about how goofy they were with this dry county law, and who dreamed that up anyway. And then I'd get in the rental car, and I figured the wet county is three counties over, and I would just gun it, and I'm just flying all over Alabama, and, if I could find people, a controller or whoever in there that had an expense account and drank like me, that was on. If I couldn't, I'd go back to my hotel room and just sit there and work on the – we had some of the first portable computers ever made, these big things about 45 pounds, compact computers. And I just sat in the hotel room and work on that so I could – and the plan was I'm gonna finish the audit early so I can get back to Richmond in time for happy hour on Friday. That was my goal. So instead of flying in late Friday and, having to fly out early Sunday and all this stuff, I'm going to get back Thursday night and tear it up Friday and Saturday, and then I'll be ready to go back to work on Sunday afternoon. So that was the plan there. So I finally quit, got tired of walking to the ice machine. I just started drinking the beer hot and just tore up. I woke up at one place. I had the whole hotel staff in my room. I don't know how they got in there. We'd been swimming. That was all I could figure out about it. But weird stuff like that, you know. But I didn't think anything about any of this. When I was up at school almost flunking out and getting these letters from the dean saying we're going to ask you to leave, I thought the kids that weren't drinking like me didn't know how to have fun. I thought they were afraid of life. I thought they just didn't I didn't know what to make of them. It never occurred to me that while I'm out drunk on Monday, and I got an event, came up with a drinking event for pretty much every night of the week. While I'm out doing this, there's thousands of people over in that giant library, you know. I mean, I guess I had some awareness of it. It just didn't occur to me I should be one of them. So anyway, I'm rolling on and got this chicken counting job going. And I impress those people. Second week in that company, we're going to all go down to Shaco Bottom in Richmond and get to know each other. They got to know more about Kent than they could have imagined going into this deal, because I was drunk as I don't know what, man. I was drinking at four or five times the rate of everybody else in the office, and they're kind of chuckling about it. And one thing after another, I walked out of that room, out of that last bar we were in. I fell into a parking meter and almost broke my arm. I stumbled up. I'm following the group on around this corner. It occurs to me I'm tired. And I look, and there's a row of cars parked, and so I went under one to take a nap. And so I crawl under this thing, and while I'm out with the whole office crew, I'm crawling under a car to take a nap. And they were up in front of me, and then I heard one of them say, "Where's Kent?" And then somebody said, "I think I see his feet back there." Well, they came and pulled me out from under a car. Look, I don't set out to get drunk and take a nap under a car in front of an entire office. This is just what alcoholism does to me, you know. So anyway, they were getting ready to fire me down there. Same thing, cut the drinking back, knuckled down on it. Hooked up with a guy who was getting a master's degree in information systems, helped them automate all these audits, ended up saving them tens of thousands of dollars by the end of the second year. They wanted to promote me, but I was done with them. They were now had mistreated me, and they were beneath me with their chicken counting operation, and I left them in the lurch. They had me set up to go out and talk to, like, for 6 weeks to go out and meet with management of these companies they audited and present our reports to them. And the week before I'm supposed to get on the plane, I said, "Goodbye, I'm going on to the next job." And it was their fault, right? One, they treated me poorly, they hadn't trained me properly, and on it went in my alcoholic mind. Then I left there. I took this other job, and that was actually a good fit for me, you know, being a guy from the country. I'm working within this agro analysis business. I've got these business degrees. So anyway, next company I went into, it's all three-piece suits and ties and stuffy, and I never was comfortable in there. I worked as a financial analyst and a couple of other jobs in this place for over 7 years. Every single day in there, I knew I was smarter than everybody in the building, and every single day in there, I said, "My God, I hope they don't fire me today." And that's how it was. Well, finally, our company got bought out. So they're now cutting the workforce by about 50%. Well, I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm actually going to get more work and get promoted. Well, they came to me a couple of days before the promotion, and they said, "Kent, we want to see you do the new job because you're going into a new area of the company, you know." And so we're going to wait, whatever, 3 months, 6 months, and if it's going well, we'll give you the promotion. And I should have just been happy. I should have had gratitude. My wife had just had a baby and quit her job about a month earlier, maybe 2 months earlier, whatever it is. But I'm there, and that alcoholism gets on me. I start thinking, man, they're trying to get rid of me. Why? This is embarrassing. Everybody else got their promotion but me and this one other person. How does that make me look, you know? And that's the type of stuff that's just rolling through my head. And finally, one day, I'm going out to lunch late. My boss is coming back in from lunch, a nice sunny afternoon, as friendly as anything. He goes, "Good afternoon, Kent." I said, "F you, Phil." And, you know, I wasn't in those construction sites and tobacco fields anymore. You don't sit in the corporate office and tell your boss what to do. And so they got rid of me, and I had to put the alcoholic mind into high gear and figure out how. Oh, yeah, my wife quit her job last month. All right, got to get some work going. What am I going to do? Went to a couple of interviews, didn't get the financial analyst-type jobs. Babysitter had the answer. Went to drop the kid off at the babysitter one day. She said, "You ought to go sell real estate." I got to thinking about it. I said, "It's low cost to get into. You can get a license in a week, and it looks like some people are making money in it. I'm in." Well, look, I'm a guy that's hated salespeople his whole life. Never liked them, never liked dealing with them, never liked anything about the sales process. I've now signed myself up to go into a 100% commission sales job with my wife having quit her job, and this is what I'm going to do. And I'm a total introvert. I've been sitting at computers grinding away at numbers my whole career, you know. I've now got a BS in econ, a BS in finance, and an MBA. I went to 4 years of night school while I was at the tobacco company financial analyst position, and so now I've got three degrees and 10 years experience. I've thrown it away like this, and I made a decision to just keep it thrown away like this. And I can't explain why that stuff happens other than to say I believe it's alcoholism as it manifested in me. I don't believe I have to be drunk to do stuff that's stupid. In fact, I know I don't, because I've looked at it in sobriety and seen it for what it is, right? So anyway, I'm now, and I'm drinking, but I'm still, I don't think I have a problem, you see, because I'm getting to work every day, and I don't have any real health problems. And so me and whoever's running around town pretty much every night, starting at happy hour, drinking. If we don't run into any girls that want to talk to us, we go to Stonewall Cafe down there and get two or three of these Long Island iced teas in glasses about this big to finish the night off and then drive on home, right? So that's how that was going. Anyway, a bad thing happened. I went in to get a physical so I could have another eye surgery done. I had a bunch of them by this time over that accident I told you about. And the doctor, and we call it the doc in the box. Today they're called patient first. When they first came out, we call it doc in the box. We thought it was all quacks working in there, you know. I said, well, I just need this paper saying I've had the physical so I can get the surgery. They can do that, right? Guy comes in, he says, how long have you had diabetes? And I'm looking around the room to see who he's talking to. And then when it becomes, he says, yeah, you got it, and you need to start on insulin right away. When he said that, the anger in my head almost exploded. And I understand today that emanated out of fear. You know, when I got to AA, I said I wasn't afraid of anything. I just wasn't aware of it. The fear was dominating my life. And this was an example of it. I'm like angry at this guy. I'm like, if he knew anything, if he were a real doctor, he wouldn't be here docking the box. I drove across the street to Hardee's and ate two sausage and egg biscuits just to show him that food didn't hurt Kent. And this is real alcoholism. I've now got a life-threatening diagnosis, right? If you don't treat type 1 diabetes, you'll be dead in short while. I just put it out of my mind. I went on to work and thought twice about it. I'm not going to go get a second opinion or anything else. Well, in about 6 weeks, I couldn't walk up the steps to the third floor apartment I was in. So I said, I better go down to Medical College of Virginia and get this checked out by a real doctor. And I went down there. The guy said, you're diabetic. You need to start on the insulin right away. Well, even an alcoholic of my variety would know that this one is not something you can dodge, right? And he said, and let's talk about your lifestyle. And so we went through diet and exercise and insulin regimen. And he said, how much do you drink? And I put about a third of it on him. And he looked at me kind of concerned. He said, well, if I were you, I wouldn't drink anymore. And I said, not any. He said, well, you could have a beer every once in a while. And then I did what any good alcoholic could do. I said, sure, I can do that. And I walked on out the door. Well, I'm almost in a panic. I'm like, what am I going to do? Well, by this time, I can't really drink the way I need to drink at home. I'm married. I got 3 kids. My wife doesn't understand why I'm as drunk as I am and doesn't appreciate it. So I hang out at the divorce guy's houses around town or wherever, and I'm drinking and all day Saturday and maybe go over there Sunday after Sunday and kick it off. And I'm getting really, really drunk on the weekends, and then I'm kind of drinking whatever at night around the house while I'm cutting grass or whatever we're doing there. So I go around to all these guys I'm hanging out with, and I say, that doctor told me not to drink anymore. And what should I do? And they all said the same thing. They said, Kent, just smoke more marijuana. And so that's what I did. One guy said, I take it with me everywhere I go. I said, no, this guy has a real solution. Why couldn't a doctor have come up with something like this, huh? And so that's what I did. I'm now like just messed up around the clock a lot of weeks, and I hated my guts. It's no longer fun and games. I'm now 42 years old, and I can't parent my kids. I'm out here trying to coach soccer, and all I'm thinking is, can I get in those woods and get high before those 26 soccer moms find out about it? I mean, does that even sound in the realm of possibility to anybody that 26 soccer moms wouldn't know some intoxicated dudes out there with their kids? But that's how crazy life got. But I was so delusional, I just never could see any problem in my life, you know? And I'm like, my kids just need too much attention, you know? Like, my wife is too sensitive. My God, why does she blow up and throw my stuff away and pour my liquor down the sink? And why does she keep doing this, you know? Why do my clients need me to go measure the carpet on Wednesday when they're closing on Friday? Why can't they wait till Friday? You know, I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot, according to the literature and according to my own history. And that's how it was. Everything was about me, and I'm like, what's the big deal if they would just leave me alone a couple of hours here and there during the day? I'd be okay. And I'm just messed up, and that got progressively worse. Well, finally, my brother-in-law had. Well, I'll tell you one other thing about that. I don't want to dwell on pot too long because we're at AA, but I'm probably not the first alcoholic that came with the idea to treat his alcoholism because he had a health reason for doing it, that he couldn't handle all those calories and booze anymore. So I start fighting this thing. I'm getting up at 5:30 in the morning, and I get stoned, and I've got a 1 o'clock appointment. And I say, man, if my wife and kids would just get out of the house. I felt so relieved when they left, I had to go get high again. And then I said, well, I still got several hours before this appointment. And now I'm like getting high again before the appointment. Finally, I'm calling them up at 1 o'clock counseling the thing. I'm supposed to be there at 1 o'clock. I said, I can beat this. I'm not some weak-willed wimp that rolled out here if he couldn't handle his problems, you know. So what I did, I started drinking a lot of water. After I smoked this stuff, I'd drink a ton of water. I'd take a handful of antihistamines, and I'd put in the clear eye drops. And I'm in pretty good shape, other than my clothes stink because I'm riding around in the car filling it up with smoke all the time. I pull in the food line. They've got these things called lemon wipes in there that have just come out. I don't know if they're for babies, furniture, or automobiles, but they smell. They got a tremendous smell to them. I bought a case of them, and man, I'm gonna get to that 1 o'clock appointment. I go back out there. I got my suit on. I start wiping it down. Mr. Lemon is here to list your house. Well, I never had a problem because I'm still getting my bills paid, right? Never mind all this business that's flying by me that I can't reach out and grab. That's all I got to do. And I had a tremendous drive to, I'd go door to door and knock on 300 doors a week is how I got this business falling in my lap after years of doing that, all that prospecting, you know. And then all the fruits of that are coming in. I'm too drunk to go get the business. And man, it's just a frustrating way of living. My brother-in-law had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's a bad example of alcoholism, if there ever was one. A bad example of humanity, as far as I was concerned. I've, like, loaned this guy money. I've driven him all over the country, moving him from one school and medical residency to another because they keep kicking him out, and nobody can figure out why. My wife's over cleaning all these liquor bottles and beer cans out of his house. I'm ticked off about that because our house is dirty. And I was just a clown living in my basement, you know. I said, yeah, I want you to come out with me to AA. I said, oh, here's Phil in AA. Well, something in me was like, man, you probably ought to go check it out, you know. And so I got in the car and I went out there, and they opened the door. It was like 75 people. I was like, wow, I thought it was going to be Phil and one dude in a trench coat from under the Lee Bridge, you know. And everybody started talking, and I could totally relate to it. I heard about how they were fighting the urge to drink and losing over and over, and how they had finally gotten sober. And I related to that losing over and over part. I said, I had no idea there were this many people fighting it the way I'd been fighting it, you know. And same thing as that thing at work where I'm worried about getting fired and I'm smarter than everybody. Now I'm totally relating into this thing, but I'm looking around going, why does that guy weigh 300 pounds? Why has this one got 5 DUIs? Nobody, I couldn't even get a DUI. You must not be trying if you got 5 of them. And this one doesn't have their family. This one doesn't have a driver's license. I don't think there's any help for me here. But anyway, I go out and, you know, I try to get sober a while, and I can't do it. I'm trying to eat better and exercise better and all this stuff and read a self-help book. Doesn't help me any. I'm drunk again. I'm back to AA. And finally I said, man, I'm just going to really do this thing. I can now see that these people are happy and sober, you know. and I'm listening to them. I understand they were had the same thing I've got, and so I really start trying to do the deal. I get a sponsor, but I never fully engaged in that relationship, you know. I went through steps 5 or 7 with 3 different sponsors, but I wouldn't finish my step work. And the reason I wouldn't finish is because I looked at it with my alcoholic mind and said, I'll lose my professional license if I go trying to amend the stuff I've done, you know. And when I got sober and did it, none of that happened. It was just, you know, just went on through it and got it done. And so I never finished my step work. I wasn't fully engaged in sponsorship. I was going to 5 or 6 meetings a week. Well, our tradition say we're going to operate in groups, right? So I'd sign up for a home group, but I didn't really know anybody in there. I never got active in there. I may as well have signed up for the whatever, quilt knitting or something. I mean, you know. So it didn't do any good. So as a result of not finishing my step work, I never got rid of the obsession that kept driving me back to drink against my own will. As a result of not being sponsored, when that obsession hit me, I didn't have anywhere to turn at that moment, you know. I just said, well, I'm not going to bother that poor guy. I'm going to go get drunk. And as a result of staying drunk, I could never do any meaningful service work. I could set up some chairs, and I still do that stuff. But in order to really transform my life and start to get better, I've got to be able to pull some other people out of the fire. I didn't have that solution to give anybody. So I basically was in it for 3 years trying to get to 5 and 6 meetings a week and barely able to get sobered up in time to get to them and just tired of it, you know. I'm tired of trying to get sobered up in time. I'm tired of it not working. And then I thought about it, and I had the answer. I said if AA worked, I wouldn't still be drunk. And then I had the craziest thought any human ever had. I said, this time I'll handle it myself. Well, they asked me in sobriety, they said, how long were you fighting it? And I started looking back. I said, well, I remember marking days off on a calendar back in 1992, how long I could stay sober. And if I made it to 12 days, that was a long stretch. Sometimes I couldn't make it 12 hours or 2 hours, you know. I said, wow. And then I remembered after that, my dad passed away, and I'd been to his funeral and down in that little county where everybody knew him, and he had run the little league and been big in the low, in the church up the street and done all this stuff. And I saw the respect the community had for him, and I said, man, I'm going to be the guy Dad tried to raise me to be. And that kept me sober about 2 weeks. I said, wow. And then I'm looking. I said, all this stuff, I started fighting it really badly like 20 years ago. And now I'm tired of AA, and I've got the idea this time I'll handle it myself. So that's what I did. I set out to handle it myself, and it just got progressively worse. I'm lucky I didn't kill somebody with my car. I'm lucky. I know my wife was starting to wonder if she'd made a bad decision. You know, my health is starting to go down. Still, you know, still fighting the business deal and the whole thing and just life. I'm just fighting life worse than ever. But it all blew up in one little incident one day. I'm out putting 2 patios on the back of the house, and 2006, and money's raining out of the sky in real estate. Even Mr. Lemon can make a few sales. And so I've got money. I'm putting 2 patios on the back of my house, and I've got about 4 or 5 guys out there working on it. My neighbor, who's 30 years Navy retired, comes over. He now watches the neighborhood as his primary job, the best I can tell. Don, here comes Don. Don said, Kent, how you doing? What are you doing? And instead of just saying, hey, Don, how are you? I said, I want Don to like me. I want Don to understand what a big deal all this work in my house is, how we're improving the property and improving the neighborhood, in fact. And I started telling Don what we're doing. And I went on for 5-6 minutes, and I put in little details like, Don, see that guy? Looks like he's squirting out cake mix. That's really mortar, Don. Finally, Don steps into my face like this far away and got on his full Navy mode, and he said, Kent, you'd make a lot more sense if you didn't smoke so much dope. I said, my God, the neighbors are on to me. I thought nobody knew. I've been hiding in the basement, in the little outbuilding, in the deserted roads. And then it occurred to me, I said, if Don knows, everybody knows. And that hit me like a ton of bricks. I said, my God, my kids know I'm messed up. My wife knows I'm messed up. And I couldn't take it. And I walked inside, and the alcoholism came back for about a minute. Said, you should go talk to Don. Couldn't do it. I sat down. I said, I'm done. And then I started looking up the number of a guy I'd met right before I left AA. I knew I wanted him to sponsor me. And I went and got this guy. He said, well, we'll meet and talk about it. I said, no, I just want to do it. What do we do? So I drove out to Ashland every Saturday morning, which is my big real estate time, or one of them, and I'm doing step work out there for about 4 months till we got through the steps. He said, Ken, it's time to go to work. I said, what is this guy talking about now? He knows I've got a job. He said, AA is not here yakking at each other. He said, we're going to get out here and help some drunks recover. He said, meet me down at Richmond City Jail next week. We're going to try to get you cleared to go in there. Here comes the alcoholism. I know what's best, right? I've never been arrested. Mark, they won't relate to me. I won't be of any use in there. He said, Kent, you are a drunk. They're going to relate to you fine. And I went down there, and I got cleared. And later I got cleared out in Powhatan Correctional in the Powhatan Receiving and Classification Unit, and it became the most rewarding stuff I've ever done in my life, other than having kids, the best I can remember. And it's just amazing. My mind, and my new sponsor says, you can't solve problems of the mind with the mind, but that's what I was always trying to do, you know. Instead of just looking at the sober people and going, all right, what did you do? Can you show me how to do it? When can we do it? I'm thinking about why it won't work. How could it possibly relate? How can starting a home group in Powhatan Prison make me a better dad? How can it make me a better husband? None of this stuff makes sense, but I started to experience it. And when I started to experience it, I knew it was real, and I became willing to keep engaged in it and keep doing it. And the more I did it, the better my life got in every area. And I said, man, this thing actually works. I'm a guy that never bought into any organization. Especially if you talked about God or passed a hat around or any of that stuff, I knew you were up to no good. And you were just out to scoff some money off of people. And so anyway, it was hard for me to integrate into AA and into recovery. And now it's just so critical in my life and so meaningful. And there's so much joy in it. I just can't even explain it. I can go anywhere, and I know people in AA, you know. And all that stuff they talk about in the literature, and I was told all those years there, drunk. It all happened when I became willing to do it with enough patience and perseverance to just keep at it. So I didn't have the answers to any of this stuff, as it turned out, but my sponsor and his sponsor did, and my home group did. And so when I got in there and I finished that step work and got busy in an active home group, finding the drunks where they are and creating programs to give them a solution to their alcoholism, life just took off. And it doesn't mean it doesn't have challenges or isn't hard at times. I think it's very hard at times. The hits keep coming. I mean, I don't know what I've been through. We're talking about it tonight. I've had heart surgery and in recovery. I went blind one day in recovery. I was standing in the backyard, and I was doing this yard work, and it was really hot. I was sweating. I thought I had sweat in my eyes, but I couldn't wipe it out. And finally, I was like looking through shattered glass, and I could only see about, I don't know, 60, 70% of what I'm supposed to be seeing. And my sponsor was in the medical field, and I called him up. I said, this guy knows all about medicine. He'll have some ideas on what to do here. He said, well, can you see it all? I said, yeah, I can see about 60, 70%. He said, can you drive? Here I'm like, my God, what is he up to now? He said, well, I thought he was going to talk to me about the medical aspects of it. He says, I'm speaking down at Rubicon tonight at 8 o'clock. Why don't you drive down there? And he hung the phone up. I thought that was a little cold, but I went on down there. I'm now a guy that surrendered. I'm now a guy that understands that this stuff will work and I don't have the answers, but they seem to come to me through AA somehow. And I went down there and I started talking to the guys and working and on some of them and all that, and my eyesight starts to get a little better. But the thing is, I now had the discipline to go to the ophthalmologist and follow his instructions exactly and not run out of fear from what the possible outcomes of this thing were. Same thing with the heart disease, you know. I don't know. I had both, I had my mom died in a few years back. I mean, just all sorts of stuff. My kids become a type 1 diabetic, and and the principles of AA have helped me get through all that stuff, you know. And my kids are all coming along pretty well at different rates. And the neat thing is, I don't have to like get my pride caught up in it. I don't have to get all these character defects coming through me into my kids now and driving wedges into that relationship. There are a lot of times I don't have the perfect answers, but I'm interacting in a way that they're still open to hearing it if I ever come up with something, you know. And I'm interacting in a way that they respect and appreciate, you know. And all that came out of sponsoring people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, because that family role model I came out of was not a good one, right? So anyway, this thing has literally impacted every area of life. I literally wouldn't be here without it. I wouldn't have made it through that heart thing that I went through. I wouldn't have driven drunk thousands of more times and not killed myself or someone else or both, you know. So I don't have any doubt about any of that stuff. It's sustained my life, and two, it's actually given me an ability to live how I always wanted to live, as a decent father, a decent husband, somebody that could contribute to some guys getting well because they've got the same illness that I have, and a member of the community, you know. Guy Don and I are like this today. We go riding around in his car and checking out his rental properties, and my neighbors asked me to get their mail. My neighbors used to look at me like they were hoping I would vanish and never come back, you know. And the whole thing's just truly been a miracle and a blessing. But I couldn't do any of it alone. It's all because you guys have been here the whole way, and the solution comes through all of us and by all of us working together. And thank you for being here, and thank you for having me tonight.